Coming up on Athens News Matters, while some Athens-Clark County commissioners push for a new downtown historic district, some local business owners say no thanks.
We had to get permission from somebody else to do something on your own property, and I'm just against it.
Plus, our panel breaks down a busy week in news and politics.
And I thought the principal did a pretty good job of being transparent. Like, he gave everyone the discipline data and was like, this is not where we want to be at right now. Like, we can see that we have problems here.
This is Athens News Matters. I'm Alexia Ridley.
And I'm Chris Shue. Also today, living in harmony with urban wildlife. Those stories, plus we review the new release from Athens Rockers of Montreal, coming up on Athens News Matters.
Morning Edition is everywhere.
Monrovia,
Sao Paulo,
Beirut,
London. Reporting from bunkers, alleys, jungles, and deserts. But most importantly, we're wherever you are. Start your day with a trip around the world and wake up with Morning Edition from NPR News.
This is Athens News Matters from WUGA News. I'm Alexia Ridley.
And I'm Chris Shoup. Did you know that the building on Clayton Street, currently home to Empire South, was originally an auto dealership built around the year 1920? And right next door, now home to The Last Resort, was another, different auto dealership built in the early 20th century. Little King's, formerly a grocery store, then a bakery, built in the 1890s. So while the business within them may change over the decades, many of the buildings in the western edge of downtown are historic. Some local leaders are pushing a historic district to preserve those structures. WUGA's Megan Wan reports.
Crossing the threshold into Wilson's His and Hers Styling Shop on the hot corner in downtown Athens is like walking into a place stuck in time. Wood paneling, faded posters advertising various hairstyles, and reclining barber chairs line the walls. Right in the midst of it all, giving the latest in thousands of haircuts, stands Homer Wilson, owner and shop runner of Wilson Styling Shop since 2008. He took the shop over from his late father, who originally opened the shop in the mid-1960s on the Hot Corner, the historically black business district in downtown Athens. Wilson Styling Shop is part of a new historic district proposed by the Athens-Clark County Historic Preservation Commission. The district would extend roughly from Lumpkin to Pulaski and Clayton to Hancock and aims to protect the historic buildings of downtown, specifically those on the Hot Corner. Tommy Valentine is Executive Director of Historic Athens.
It is as important to us understanding ourselves as UGA is, as the rest of downtown Athens is, as any neighborhood or street in this community.
But, ironically, the very thing meant to protect Wilson Styling Shop and the building surrounding it has been met with opposition from some building owners.
Well, I'm not for it. I'm not for the historic district. We really don't want that to go to somebody actually. Can I paint it? Can I sell it?
Wilson, along with Theodore Brown of Brown's Barbershop, Athens First United Methodist Church, and John Wade, property owner of the Manhattan Cafe, are just a few of the more vocal opponents of the new historic district. All of downtown Athens, from the Classic Center to the 40 Watt, is a National Historic District. But while it's considered an honor to be recognized as a National Historic District, all you really get out of it is a nice bronze plaque and a promise from the federal government that they won't run a highway through it. Tommy Valentine again.
Where the real action is in a local historic district. A local historic district sets design guidelines. It guides new development. It doesn't seek to end development, but it does seek to guide it.
Right now, the east side of downtown, so from around the Georgia Theater to the Classic Center, is covered by a local historic district. According to Athens-Clark County Commissioner Russell Edwards, being in a local historic district, like the one proposed, basically requires property owners to navigate some extra bureaucratic red tape before renovating or demolishing their buildings.
If put in place, a local historic district would require property owners to apply to the Historic Preservation Commission for a certificate of appropriateness before making changes to the exterior of the building. Say if there's a building owner that wants to make a change to the facade, maybe put a different entryway or make changes to the windows, the Historic Preservation Commission will consider the proposal with input from our planning department and then issue a recommendation.
not all business owners are opposed to the new historic district. Drew Deakle, owner of the Flicker Building, has been quoted in Flagpole magazine as 100% in favor. And he's backed by the likes of Edwards, Valentine, and District 3 Commissioner Melissa Link, who want a West Side District because of its ability to protect iconic buildings like the Morton and all the other buildings that make the Hot Corner what it is. But Homer Wilson says Hot Corner will always be Hot Corner, regardless of the buildings.
Builders can come, builders can go. It's going to be Hot Corner to the day when the trumpet sounds. It's going to be Hot Corner.
At the heart of the argument are two conflicting interests. The short-term interests of independence and autonomy by business owners versus the longer-term interests of preservation by the HPC. Tommy Valentine again.
One of the things that gives historic preservation a bad reputation is when we seem reactive. But if you can designate an area carefully with good design guidelines, if you can work with property owners and support the changes that they're making, if you can do all of that together, then you preserve history, you have new development, you have a growing and prospering community, and you can do all of it at once.
The Athens-Clarke County Mayor and Commission are scheduled to vote on the new district in June. For Athens News Matters, I'm Megan Wan.
Since the 2008 recession, the number of discount stores, Dollar General, Family Dollar, and the like, has exploded, leaving some local governments pondering their effects on the availability of healthy food and underserved communities. WUGA contributor Alex Vandenhoevel has this report.
DeKalb County, Georgia, has nearly 70 so-called dollar stores. But at least for the next 5 months, no more will be built. Joining in a growing nationwide movement pushing back against dollar stores, the DeKalb County Commission recently voted to extend a moratorium on the building of, quote, small-box discount stores, end quote, commonly referred to as dollar stores. In recent years, local governments around the U.S. have taken similar actions to restrict the construction of dollar stores and other chain stores, including Tulsa, Oklahoma, New Orleans, San Francisco, and Mendocino County, California. DeKalb County Commissioner Lorraine Cochran Johnson is a vocal advocate of the moratorium.
The issue initially rose during town hall meetings.
Constituents were concerned when two grocery stores in the heart of DeKalb County shut their doors. Cochran Johnson says that after those closings, residents started to point out that there were dollar stores in abundance, but very few sources of fresh food. DeKalb County already has several neighborhoods that will be defined as food deserts. The USDA defines a food desert as an urban or suburban location that is more than 1 mile away from a grocery store, or a rural location that is more than 10 miles from a grocery store. University of Georgia Assistant Professor of Geography Jerry Shannon says that the food offered by dollar stores is typically a far cry from fresh produce.
We can recognize that in large part they do tend to have the same kinds of stuff you'd see in any gas station or corner store, right? Highly processed foods that aren't necessarily all that nutritionally rich.
In a written statement, Dollar General, one of the largest dollar store chains in the country, said that they offer what they characterize as components of a healthy diet, like milk, eggs, and lean proteins. Cochran Johnson says that in DeKalb County, the dollar store industry disproportionately targets southern DeKalb. Looking at the five DeKalb County Commission districts, the two wealthier and whiter districts have just three dollar stores combined, while the other three districts that have majority-minority communities and have lower median household incomes contain the other 60-plus dollar stores.
You know, people lie, numbers don't. There is an issue here.
We've seen just over the last 5 years, at least in my quick mental count, probably half a dozen of these open up in Athens-Clarke County or immediately on our periphery.
That's Kelly Gertz, mayor of Athens-Clarke County. In fact, while Clarke County only has about 18 dollar stores in or near the county, it has more dollar stores per person than DeKalb. One of Jerry Shannon's primary research focuses is urban development and inequality and how that topic relates to food accessibility and community health. He says that the South has been ground zero for a dollar store explosion over the past few years.
In the wake of the recession, really, is where we see a lot of this growth. And certainly there were plenty in Georgia at the beginning, but even in Georgia, what we've seen is just an explosion in the density of these stores. If you look at the three biggest chains, it almost just looks like it's a wave sweeping over from the Southeast up through the rest of the country.
There are now more dollar stores in America than Walmart and McDonald's locations combined. From a researcher's standpoint, Athens has fewer food deserts than you might expect due to the small geographic footprint of the town. That said, there are still neighborhoods in northern or eastern Athens where residents might have to put in a lot of effort to access fresh food. Shannon says that the growth of the dollar store industry is a progression in the evolution of local economies that started with the growth of Walmart in the 90s.
what you're seeing is kind of a second wave of these smaller stores coming in ways that still are very corporate and can be seen as very extractive of wealth from local communities.
Shannon's research seems to back up Lorraine Cochran Johnson's claim that dollar stores generally crop up in locations with higher levels of households with lower or lower middle incomes. This pans out in Northeast Georgia as well. For example, Oconee County has two dollar stores, while Madison County has eight stores. And by the way, Oconee County's median family income is $35,000 more than Madison County's. ACC Mayor Kelly Gertz says that he prefers the carrot of incentives to the stick of legislation.
Incentivizing what we want is probably where we'll continue to see things. Honestly, given our physical geography, it's hard to imagine too many more of these.
Shannon, the UGA professor, says that the conversation around dollar stores is complicated because residents of the community and local policymakers may be looking at different aspects of their existence.
Dollar stores are tricky because I do think a lot of people really do feel like they're a valuable resource. At the same time, I think the response you're seeing from local lawmakers is also warranted in as much as it reflects a feeling of loss of control for them.
Local governments have a long history of trying to control the sorts of businesses that set up shop in their area. Athens-Clarke County has its own moratorium to prevent new bars and luxury student housing high-rises from being built downtown. Shannon says that it's also important to recognize the historical context of why certain neighborhoods don't have the resources to foster local business ownership. He also points out that a moratorium alone is not a silver bullet.
You can't just get rid of dollar stores and expect people then to go look for, you know, whatever option you think they should be shopping for. You have to recognize that there's a legitimate issue there that you need to be proactive at trying to address.
In Dollar General's written statement, the company stressed their commitment to working with DeKalb County officials to find a compromise. However, local governments in places like Clark or DeKalb will ultimately have to decide if inexpensive things come at too great a cost. For Athens News Matters, I'm Alex VandenHeuvel.
I'm Paul Farr. I am the marketing director for Athens Area Habitat for Humanity. Since underwriting with WUGA, we feel that we have strengthened our ties with the community and that the community at large better understands what we do. WUGA believes everyone should have access to knowledge and wonder. So we build homes for the body. WUGA builds a home for the mind and the heart. And we believe that both are necessary for a good life. So if you want to find out how you can become an underwriter, just email wuga@uga.edu.
This is Athens News Matters from WUGA News. I'm Alexia Ridley, and joining me now in our studio to talk about the week in news and politics are Lee Shearer with the Athens Banner-Herald, Blake Aud with Flagpole Magazine, and Aaron Schilling with the Red and Black. Let's start today with the Clark County School District. Chase Street Elementary Principal Nikki Hittle is leaving the school. What's going on at Chase Street?
This is the third principal to leave in 2 years, and one of many that have left the school district in the last couple of years.
So something's happening.
Well, this is actually my daughter's school, so I've heard a lot of the scuttlebutt. I mean, Lee's kind of got the gist of it. She wasn't particularly popular with the teachers, and, you know, I never had an issue with her personally, but I've heard a lot of things, and the general sentiment seems to be that this is probably a good move for Chase Street Elementary. But as Lee mentioned, there's been a lot of turmoil, and the previous two principals were pretty well-liked, especially Adam Kurtz, who'd been there for
and
about
Derek
10 or 11
Maxwell
years.
And Derek Maxwell at Cedar was very well-liked as
That's
well.
That's true, too, yeah.
I thought it was interesting that her resignation was effective immediately. Is that Has that been common in Clark County?
No, that's very unusual for an educator to leave in the middle of the school year, because they have a contract, and generally, regardless of whether they're leaving or they're being asked to leave, usually you would either, you know, your contract would run out either way. So that's not typical.
Well, we had another resignation in the last week, and that was Brian Perito, who's the band director at Clark Middle?
Yes.
Yes. Now, in this case, he gave people a lot more information about why he decided to leave.
Well, he mentioned two things primarily, lack of support, stagnant funding for not only music but arts programs at Clark Middle and the rest of the school district. And he says discipline problems are on the rise, which led to an online barrage of criticism, I guess, about the school district's new approach to discipline, which is more one of education and behavior change than punishment. Some people don't think it's really working.
I went to the a listening session at Clark Middle School with the principal, and it was a pretty good turnout. It was a completely full cafeteria, probably about 100 parents who came to talk about the band program specifically and then also the disciplinary problems there. And I thought the principal did a pretty good job of being transparent. Like, he gave everyone the discipline data and was like, this is not where we want to be at right now. Like, we can see that we have problems here, and kind of address the problems of, like, some parents suggested that he should have an assistant, but he was saying that there aren't any resources to have an assistant band director, that he would put paraprofessionals in special education classes instead.
Did you have an idea after listening to this that Perito's concerns were unfounded?
I don't think that they were unfounded, but I don't think they were atypical for a middle school band. I think that there's just underfunding in education in general across the state and the nation, especially for fine arts programs.
How do you guys think the recent resignations in the past few years affect Clark County's ability to attract qualified candidates? Do you think that they're scared off? Do you think that it is no different from other districts?
I know that there have been several positions that they've had a hard time filling. I mean, we mentioned a couple of the principal vacancies, and I don't know if it's a thing that snowballs, you know, where all of the departures are going to scare people off. But I think in a lot of cases, it's probably the numbers. If you look at some of the school's test scores, I could see someone looking for a job going, I don't know if I can deal with this. You know, I don't know if I can fix this or want to, because it's a really, really difficult thing to do. You know, those all are potential factors.
I think things may ease a bit now that Demond Means is not at the helm anymore, although the school board has plenty of problems remaining to deal with. I noticed scrolling through Facebook today that the Cedar Shoals kid called for Antoine Stevens, the board member recently appointed, to step down.
They wrote the blueprints, the student paper over there wrote what I thought was a very well-reasoned, mature editorial, but mature with the exception of the Scooby-Doo joke they made, which I thought was chef's kiss. I mean, that was great, but it was a really good editorial, and it really laid out, you know, its reasoning very well.
And we also wanted to discuss the Bethel Homes redevelopment. We are moving off from the school districts and on to another topic, and that is the Bethel Homes redevelopment meeting that was held this week. And what's the latest there?
It's the very beginning of the planning process for the redevelopment of the Bethel Midtown Village, not technically a public housing project, but a Section 8 affordable housing project that dates back to the 60s and has become quite dilapidated and recently changed hands. The company that owned it sold it to the Athens Housing Authority, and there's a major push to redevelop not just Bethel, but some of the Housing Authority properties surrounding it and some other government-owned properties surrounding it, north of Doherty Street around College Avenue. And the residents are being involved from the very beginning, which hopefully will alleviate a lot of the mistrust that we've seen stemming from some similar types of redevelopment projects that happened back in the 60s where residents were not involved at all.
A couple of weeks ago, the Athens Housing Authority got to be in charge of maintenance, and they started a process of bringing these apartments up to a really basic living standard, fixing people's air conditioning and leaking plumbing. Another good thing that's happened is that there's now private security patrolling the area. Last summer, the post office stopped delivering mail temporarily because of a number of shootings over there.
So that's going to have an immediate effect on the neighborhood, which is going to be great, you know, and then there's that broader project, which, you know, there's still some apprehension. I mean, you know, we heard some comments about, you know, people are just unsure about whether the rent's going to remain the same and what's going to happen to them while this is going on, where are they going to live. And Rick Parker at the Housing Authority has already addressed a lot of these concerns. You know, he's promised that everybody's rent is going to stay the same and that all moving expenses will be covered by the Housing Authority. And some people will actually be able to stay in their units while the construction is going on because it's going to be phased. We heard a lot of, you know, Lee talked about private security, heard a lot of concerns about crime. I think that was the number one concern among the residents.
There were
probably about 50 residents there, I would say, and a couple dozen other concerned people who don't live in the neighborhood. And so I think people are really interested in kind of basic stuff like Lee was talking about, like washer and dryer hookups. You know, we heard a lot about that. We heard about pest control, getting a playground, you know, things of that nature. But, you know, this is also going to be a really large scale project that's going to involve a lot of other broader issues related to land use and transportation and things like that.
One interesting aspect of this to me is you've got this big development that's about to happen over on this side of downtown. This is just the other side of Doherty Street. And pretty soon we're going to have another huge development going on around the Civic Center with a hotel, a senior living condo, and an arena, all of which is going to continue the densification, more people, more vehicles downtown.
Well, that's true, yeah. But from the standpoint of land use, really, I mean, we need more density downtown. We committed to that 20 years ago with the land use plan that we have, that we didn't want sprawl. We wanted to focus development downtown, and that's what's happening.
Finally, I know, Lee, you wanted to address something. The Board of Elections asked the ACC Commission for money due to a fairly serious issue.
Well, it's not an issue that I understand fully, but we have these new voting systems. You have a machine you vote on. You have a printer that prints out a paper ballot from that. And you have another machine that reads the codes that are printed on that paper ballot. And the county commission meeting Tuesday night, they discussed a request from the Board of Elections for money to upgrade what I heard was 18 of 20 polling places that don't meet those requirements.
You know, you basically have three times as many things that you have to plug in because you've got the scanner and the printer in addition to the voting machine. That draws a lot of power. And our local Board of Elections started looking into this a month or two ago, and they found that, like Lee said, I think 17 or 18 sites may or may not have enough capacity to handle this.
It makes me wonder what's going on in the rest of the state, too, if every county in Georgia is having to deal with this same electric issue.
I think a lot of them are because there was a state Board of Election meeting about a month ago where they talked about the requirements for the number of machines that each precinct has to have. Part of the law that the legislature passed last year that got us the new machine said that you have to have one machine for every 250 voters, I think. So that was going to mean a lot more machines at every precinct, and that was going to address some of the lines that there was a big problem with in 2018 in a lot of parts of the state, including Athens. But they tweaked that to say one out of 250 voters who didn't already vote early. So that'll reduce the number of machines that are necessary, which is going to reduce the load on, I guess, the electrical systems at a lot of these sites. But if something happens, you know, and the machines are they're only some of them are able to operate or none of them are able to operate, they're going to have paper ballots on hand for people to fill out by hand. So, you know, they do have preparations in place.
We do have a backup. And that is all the time we have for this week. I do want to thank my guests, Blake Odd, Aaron Schilling, and Lee Shearer.
My name is Morgan Fry, and I am a recently graduated master's student in journalism at Grady College. The project that I'm most proud to have contributed to while at WGA is definitely the StoryCorps Athens project. I feel really honored to be one of the few people who has listened in entirety to these StoryCorps stories, and it really helps me feel more connected to Athens. Learn more about WUGA internships at wuga.org.
This is Athens News Matters from WUGA News. I'm Chris Shoup. The future of the West Broad Street school site has periodically been a hot topic in certain parts of the Athens community. WUGA's Gemma DiCarlo brings us this story about the site's historic past and probable future.
On West Broad Street, near the busy intersection with Hancock Avenue, there sit three buildings. They're not much to look at. Simple brick buildings, a small asphalt parking lot, and a courtyard in the middle. The gold lettering might clue you into their purpose, West Broad School. But just from looking at it, you wouldn't know that this is a touchstone for the history of education and race in Athens-Clarke County.
Since the early 1890s, it has been a public education site. So, yes, it has a very rich history, as Athens has a very rich African-American educational history.
That was Fred Smith, co-chair of the Athens Area Black History Committee. As he said, the West Broad School educated many of Athens' black students from the 1890s all the way until the school district desegregated in the 1970s. It's important to note, Smith says, that children weren't the only students of the West Broad School.
During that time, you know, a school was kind of like a community center. And so not only was the building used for students during the daytime, but oftentimes there would be classes and extension classes for adults during the evening.
Given its background as a community landmark, the Clark County School District has long debated how to repurpose the West Broad School, especially without sacrificing its historic character. But the district seems to be finally moving forward with plans for construction and preservation.
They're trying to utilize that space to provide 20 new classrooms to the community that can provide early childhood education, possibly a health center. They really want to leverage the space in some super productive ways. We believe in that development. We just want to make sure that we preserve the historic integrity while it's happening.
That was Tommy Valentine, Executive Director of Historic Athens. His organization has partnered with the school district to advise the restoration of the oldest building on the West Broad site, which dates from 1938. The other two buildings hail from the equalization era, when the federal government increased spending on black schools in an attempt to justify a separate but equal system. Valentine's hope is to convince the district to repurpose these buildings as well, or at least one of them.
So there's a building on Campbell that is in phenomenal shape for an equalization era school. And so we would love to see that one be retained, new classrooms put inside it, and then the rest of the campus receive murals and interpretive signage so that visitors to the new buildings have a sense of where they are.
Either way, the district aims to add 27,000 square feet of early childhood education space on the site. Smith says that continuing the educational legacy of the West Broad School will connect students to history, something that is particularly important for black students.
Mere fact of attending that building and being told stories of the history of that, it's a way to teach history. And it's important, too, especially for African-American students to have that connection and those symbols from the past, because a lot of our symbols connected to our history have been destroyed.
For Valentine, the preservation of the West Broad School isn't about the past at all. It's about the present.
Growing up in Athens, you notice certain things about this community, about the way it works, about the way opportunity is divided, the way our neighborhoods are divided. You know, one of the things I hear all the time from people that attended Clark County Schools is that we have phenomenal schools with incredible teachers. We have incredible programs. But all too often, we graduate feeling like history happened somewhere else, that we didn't have history here. And so by preserving sites like this, it tells us our story, both what we could have done better and also what we might do better in the future.
Perhaps most importantly, it's about just that, the future.
So I have a 2-year-old daughter, soon to be 2-year-old, and it's very likely that when she attends pre-K that it'll be in one of these classrooms. It's right down the street from us. And when she starts becoming educated, it's really important. You know, we talk about experiential learning. You know, memories are buildings you can touch, whereas a textbook can only tell you so much. And as she's growing up and going to this site, and as other kids are visiting this site, we think it's critical they have context to where they are and to what's happened before them.
For Athens News Matters, I'm Gemma DiCarlo.
As urban populations expand, how does wildlife respond? The answer may seem simple, but species such as deer, coyotes, possums, and birds seem to be doing a better job of adapting to us than we are adapting to them. WUGA's Sophie Gratis spoke with some wildlife professionals to get the details on how we can manage urban wildlife around our own homes and what we need to know to avoid negative interactions.
In a state where suburbia and farmland surround a growing urban metroplex, backyard wildlife is a shared experience. Many homeowners decide to hunker down on properties with lots of land, set up bird feeders, and cheer on as families of deer move through springtime rituals. Countless studies have shown improvements in mental health and overall well-being among those who surround themselves with nature. But what happens when these animals start causing us more disruption than joy? Get on any online neighborhood chat room, listserv, or Facebook group, and you'll probably see complaints about local coyotes, pesky raccoons, and yes, even cute deer.
I think the very big challenge we have in urban wildlife management is that we can have very different spectrums in terms of people's acceptance of wildlife.
That's Michael Cole, an assistant professor in wildlife management at the University of Georgia's Warnell School of Forestry and Natural Resources. He's a spatial ecologist, mapping out where animals are, why they're there, or why they're not. Cole's research primarily focuses on coyotes and how growing urban landscapes are forcing coyotes to change their behaviors. Although attacks on humans are extremely rare, these animals have developed a somewhat sinister reputation in urban landscapes.
Coyotes have figured out very quickly that they can handle people and they can actually do really well with people. We have urban coyotes in every single large city in the United States now. And about 3/4 of those cities report conflicts with coyotes, whatever that might mean in that city.
Coyotes are one thing, but what about the smaller, peskier critters? Interactions with these guys can vary in severity, and therefore, response. UGA Wildlife Extension Specialist Michael Menjak explains different levels of response to human-wildlife conflicts.
It starts with habitat modification or harassment. We suggest that you just clean up, modify the habitat, make the habitat unsuitable for the animal. The next step of the model is exclusion. Just exclude it, build a fence. Then we work through another step, it's called repellents. So there are a lot of repellents on the markets. The last step in the model might be lethal control. It depends on who the animal is and who the homeowner is and what your tolerance is.
Working in the UGA Extension Office, Menjak has heard all kinds of complaints.
From deer in our gardens and armadillos in our yards, to somebody saw a snake, to a bird's flying into my window or a squirrel's in my bird feeder.
His biggest piece of advice? Keep it simple. Many household items can be used to ward off unwanted wildlife, such as sprays made from garlic oil or birdseed made with capsaicin from peppers. When landscaping, Menjak urges people to stay away from plants that deer or other animals might want to eat.
We've invaded their space, they've invaded our space. That's an argument that's not really all that useful to have. We just have to deal with the situation the way it is. Figure out ways to get along with wildlife. Learn the habits of wildlife, discourage them every way possible, and they won't be as much of a nuisance.
One factor is key in all of this, information. About a year ago, the Wildlife Resources Division of the Georgia Department of Natural Resources officially launched the Urban Wildlife Program in response to a growing need for public information on the subject. The team of five specifically addresses the urban wildlife needs of 9 Georgia counties.
My name is Tina Johansson, and I am an assistant chief in the game management section of the Wildlife Resources Division.
Johansson oversees this program.
A big part of what the urban program is doing, and we do this throughout our agency, it's just really highlighted and focused with the urban program, is doing educational outreach to folks and being responsive to things that come in on our social media.
Regardless of where you are, Johansson says people should reach out to DNR with any questions or concerns they may have regarding conflicts with wildlife. While friends, family, and other local organizations might be helpful for solving minor issues, professional opinions and responses are just a phone call away.
We are fortunate to have so many different species of wildlife. Sometimes they're a problem, and when they are, call us. Most of the time, it's a fairly simple fix, and we want to do that. We want to empower folks to deal with wildlife when they need to do that.
For Athens News Matters, I'm Sophie Gratis.
Thousands of women dedicate their lives to developing knowledge and finding answers to theories posed in nearly every field. In the field of ethnography, researchers observe and collaborate with people and cultures in real-life settings. But what's the cost of being a woman in this field of research? Dr. Patricia Richards' latest book, Harassed: Gender, Bodies, and Ethnographic Fieldwork, co-authored with Rebecca Hansen, explores the challenges faced by female ethnographers. Welcome.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here.
Well, let's just get right into this. Can you tell us a little bit more about ethnography, and what might the field of ethnography be prone to creating these types of situations? I mean, how do they arise in the first place?
Yeah, I think that there often is something about the field site and negotiating the specific cultural, gender, and often also racial norms of a given field site. But there's also something about the structure of the academy that makes women particularly vulnerable to harassment when they enter the field. And this is that ethnography as a field tends to idolize what Rebecca and I call the three fixations. And this is facing danger in the field as if that's a requirement of doing good ethnography, going into the field alone as if being isolated in the field is required in order to show your chops, and developing ethnographic intimacy or becoming as close as possible with the people in our field sites to come to know as much as possible about them. And so these values of the field end up making women in particular vulnerable to harassment in their field sites. And we don't really teach about it in our methods classes, and we don't talk about it in advisement sessions. And so women go into the fields feeling like they're not measuring up.
What measures do you think can be taken to better protect these women? Maybe some changes.
We're more interested in interrogating the epistemological foundations of ethnography as a field. However, that being said, there are certain recommendations that we do make in the book. I think at the individual level, we recommend such things as actually taking an embodied approach to our data, such that we are thinking about what these experiences of harassment actually can tell us about our field sites, and breaking sort of the disciplinary silences around these experiences, I think is really important. And so that's true of researchers, but it's also true of mentors. And so we're asking also mentors as well to actually strategize some ideas for how their grad students can actually deal with harassment when they face it in the field. Because it's not that we're necessarily going to be able to make it go away, but it's like saying this is, in fact, a part of field work. How can you deal with it when it happens? And so then another idea that we recommend that several of our participants actually did take up was to either collaborate with others in their field site or have others nearby, or even if others are far away, have people who you can reach out to when you have these experiences in the field. So you aren't facing them alone. And so you can sort of strategize how to deal with them, because the field ends up becoming a really amorphous work site. You know, it's like you are doing work when you're in the field, but you're not, you know, you're not in an office. So you don't have like an HR person to report to. So the way that you deal with harassment in the field ends up being really different.
Dr. Patricia Richards is a professor of sociology and women's studies at the University of Georgia and the co-author of Harassed: Gender, Bodies, and Ethnographic Research.
All Things Considered has been there through controversial wars.
Thousands of young people came to Washington.
National disasters.
Challenger, go with throttle up.
The explosion in the clear blue Florida
and breakthrough
sky.
Moments.
Just let it sink in. An African-American president of the United States of America.
4 decades of bringing you the news on All Things Considered every afternoon.
This is Athens News Matters. I'm Alexia Ridley.
And I'm Chris Shoup. Historically, artists around the world have expressed themselves and their opinions through their work. Art as a medium can turn painters into public advocates as they visually display messages for the world to see. This weekend, the University of Georgia is celebrating the use of art to promote social justice as the Lamar Dodd School of Art and the School of Social Work are hosting the 10th Annual Art and Education for Social Justice Symposium on February 21st through the 23rd. Here to talk about the event is Lynn Sanders Bussell, a co-chair of the Art and Education for Social Justice Symposium Conference. Welcome.
Sure.
So how does art education promote social justice?
We design our curriculum at UGA around equity and social justice. So basically what that means is if our students are designing instruction, we like to encourage them first to look at the systems that are in place, to critique the systems that are already in place, to better understand the needs of students, their communities, so that they can have a good idea about how to make that provocation or that experience or that intervention very relevant to the students. So really, social justice and equity are a big part of our curriculum.
Can you describe how modern artists are creating social change?
Recently, I think more contemporary artists are really moving away from a focus on art as an object. So for in other words, it used to be that artists created, for example, paintings. A lot of artists now are more focused on creating social change as opposed to a particular object. So to me, that is one of the biggest shifts. So what we're seeing is artists designing basically social interactions toward the idea that there are more just ways of being with one another. You'll see a lot of artists going into communities, working from the community, based on the community needs, in collaboration through dialogue, to then create either a new social interaction or something that the community needs.
What do you hope visitors will take home with them after attending this conference?
We would love for them to begin to think about this kind of activity, the symposium, the conference, the gathering, as kind of a charge to think about collective voice, you know, because we can do so much more in terms of social change if we're doing those things together. So what qualities are inherent in a collective voice? What are we striving for? This event will begin on Friday afternoon at 4, and we're going to be at Sine. And we did want to invite the community in. We wanted them to be an important part of our planning. And that's why we start this at Sine. At that time, we're going to have presenters, activists, and community artists that are going to speak for a short time to the attendees of the conference. And after that period, then what we're going to do is kind of open it up to kind of some natural conversations with the presenters in hopes that some of Athens' community issues are then relatable in some way to the attendees, so they can then begin to talk about the things that they care about and how they're using art in their communities. So the idea is to kind of open that up. Start with Athens, open it up. And then the next thing we know, you know, we're beginning to share ideas about how we're solving problems, not just talking about art, but how we're using art in communities. Then on Saturday, that looks a little bit more like a formal symposium in that we have probably on Saturday, I bet close to 30 to 40 speakers. And that will be at the Lamar Dodd School of Art, and it will also take place at the Georgia Museum of Art. And then Sunday, we'll pick that back up with a half day, and then we'll also have a closing session where we're going to try to bring some of these ideas together.
Lynn Sanders Bussell is an associate professor of art education at the University of Georgia and a co-chair of the Art and Education for Social Justice Symposium Conference. To find out more information about the event, visit art.uga.edu.
Athens-based indie pop Stalwarts of Montreal released their 16th studio album last month. WUGA contributor Jordan Meeker has our review.
In the 24 years since its inception, Athens indie pop band of Montreal has shown no signs of slowing down. The release of its 16th record, Your Fun, shows that frontman Kevin Barnes can still surprise and delight fans and critics. Your Fun offers 10 tracks all written by Barnes, the epicenter of the band and its only continuous member. The opening track, Peace to All Freaks, provides an example of what Pitchfork calls Barnes' tendency toward a study in contrasts. A complex analysis of today's world is layered over an upbeat dance track. You might find yourself dancing to the lines, though we find ourselves in this era's darkest heart, forces of wickedness will not tear us apart. One pleasant standout in the album is Gypsy That Remains, a song that starts with a heady dreaminess
but ascends into upbeat electropop, enhanced by the vocals of Christina Schneider, a local artist who goes by Locate S1. The back half of the album takes on a darker tone, with Don't Let Me Die in America, the album's seventh track, giving a gritty psych pop voice to Barnes' current dissatisfaction with the state of the country. Barnes tweeted an explanation of the album, writing, "The theme of Your Fun is that of a person, me, battling dissociative disorder, trying to navigate their existence amidst the careening walls of nightmare reality, and doggedly trying to keep themselves open to love and humanity." This theme comes through in the last two tracks especially, as the record closes out with the frenetic drums and electric guitar of the final song, where Barnes sings, "If everything's fake, I want to be fake. It's so lonely being the only one who thinks they're real." In all, the album offers a blend of complex lyricism and wistful, dreamy pop that Of Montreal has perfected over the years. The band will be back for a hometown show at the Georgia Theater on Thursday, February 27th, performing songs off Your Fun and more. For Athens News Matters, I'm Jordan Meeker.
You've been listening to Athens News Matters from WUGA News. The opinions expressed on the broadcast do not necessarily reflect those of WUGA or the University of Georgia.
Don't forget, you can hear all of the segments from this week's show and our past shows online at WUGA.org, as well as on the WUGA app, available for Apple and Android wherever you get your apps. For Alexia Ridley, I'm Chris Shoup, and this has been Athens News Matters from WUGA News.